right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday, March 23rd, 2018. And this says Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everyone. It is a cool spring, 30 degrees and melting here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off on Wednesday? We titled the show Sensors, Nanotech, Sustainability, Fracking, Smart Dust, and the Bushes. We had taken a look probably over the last week and a half at different technologies that are now involving nanotech, nanotech in your food packaging, nanotech in your food, nanotech in your medicine, and in your brain scans, and to cure cancer. And we discovered through some of the research that Camille, who is a listener of the show, had sent me that they had also been using nanotechnology in things such as mining and fracking. And we ended the show on Wednesday looking at the connections to the George Bush family and the Bush family inner circle to some of the mining that is going on down in Texas. And it's pretty interesting because, of course, nanotechnology is being sold as sustainable for the planet. This was a study, it was actually a chapter out of a book that Camille sent me titled Nanotechnology for Sustainability, Environment, Water, Food, Minerals, and Climate. Of course, it's all about climate change. It's all about trying to fix the planet with mad science gone mad. The global sustainability challenges facing the world are complex and involve multiple interdependent areas. Sustainable nanotechnology solutions for a clean environment, water resources, food supplies, mineral resources, green manufacturing, habitat, transportation, climate change, and biodiversity. Now, that sounds kind of like an oxymoron. We are selling nano-sized sensors to monitor everything on the planet as a part of our sustainability challenges and cures. This, of course, is going to make a happy 21st century. So we'll be able to watch how things are degrading or how they are improving as we force these new ways upon you. It also discusses nanotechnology-based energy solutions in terms of their interdependence with other sustainability target areas, such as water, habitat, transportation, and climate change. Now, one of the things that's interesting is how they are selling nanotechnology for sustainability and how some of our, and I don't remember the guy's name. By the way, we do have a very special guest today, Camille has come on the show. She's sitting very quietly. Thank you very much. We are going to have a discussion about some of these technologies and nanotech and mining and asteroids, maybe if we get there, Halliburton, and how all these things connect together. Good morning, Camille. Are you there?
Good morning.
So what are your thoughts? What was that guy's name, the video that we talked about on Wednesday, who was talking about throwing smart dust down the borehole? Do you remember?
Scott Tinker,
yeah. And he went to Boulder, Colorado, I think, was where he went to college. He was at some mining conference up there.
Yeah, and he heard about smart dust, and he said, geez, let's shove it down some wells. That's a great idea.
So we find out that in Texas, they've been going crazy fracking, and some of the technologies that they were looking at was not only mineral extraction, but also uranium, and of course, fracking is for natural gas. And one of the things I was reading last night is natural gas occurs in the Marcellus Shale Formation, which is right up through upstate New York. It starts up somewhere Syracuse, maybe even above that in Canada, and then rides all the way down on the East Coast underneath New York and Pennsylvania and into the Appalachians. But one of the things that I was reading is within the Marcellus Shale, that's where your uranium is trapped. Now, I don't know if you read the story that I shot you last night about Pennsylvania finally deciding that they were going to take a look at fracking fluids to see how much uranium is being accidentally or on purpose extracted. Did you get to read that at all?
I did. And it's very unsettling. I never even considered uranium for fracking.
Yeah, it's frightening because they're doing it everywhere. I mean, water supplies. When I had mentioned on Wednesday about going to Google Earth, and you and I talked after the show, and we went out there down to Southwest Texas over near Midland and that, and zoom in and take a look, and you're going to see all these little structures that are connected via these lines, and they almost look like a circuit board, but those are actually fracking wells. I mean, wasn't that amazing how many there were? They were everywhere.
It's insane. It was incredible to see how many wells there were. That it was worse than the 5G small cells. They're so close.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what the scale was, but go ahead.
They evenly spaced their monitors for their monitoring the earthquake activity because they've got those things so spaced everywhere. It's Texas would be a horrible place to be, I would think.
Well, problem, reaction, solution. You know, it was amazing. I was watching the one video you sent me about them setting up those earthquake monitors all over Texas. And the one scientist was saying, you know, oh, before 2010, which was when they started kicking fracking into high gear, we only would get one or two earthquakes a year. But now we're getting like 15 and we don't know what's going on. So now we got to set up these earthquake monitors. But I mean, they're fracking the crap out of the under whatever they call it, the subsurface, and they're forcing high pressure injection fluids in underneath there to fracture the rock, and then we don't know why we're getting earthquakes. So let's put sensors everywhere because that's kind of how the world is going, and nanotechnology is perfect for that type of thing. Now, a couple other things that you sent me that I wanted to kind of weave into the story was you'd sent me something. And it was out of an institute called the Foresight Institute, foresight.org. And this really caught my attention. Back in 1992, apparently there was some sort of Senate subcommittee on nanotechnology. This publication is titled Senate Interest in Nanotechnology, New Technology for a Sustainable World. Oh, it's again all about sustainability. On June 26, 1992, the U.S. Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation Subcommittee on Science, Technology, and Space held a hearing on the topic of new technologies for a sustainable world. And who was the chairman? Oh, Dr. Eric Drexler. Dr. Eric Drexler, the father of modern nanotechnology. We've listened to some interviews with him and Kurzweil before, talking about the future of molecular manufacturing. Dr. Eric Drexler, chairman of the Foresight Institute and a research fellow of the Institute for Molecular Manufacturing, was invited to testify on molecular nanotechnology. The following is written testimony he submitted in a later issue. We'll cover the oral portion. And I don't know if this is pretty long, but I will link to this in the notes. But another thing that came out of this very same publication that you sent me was there was another section titled Vice President Al Gore on Nanotechnology. Now, wait one second. Wasn't Al Gore, man, bear pig, Mr. Sustainability, global warming, we need to save the planet? Oh, yes, he was. I mean, this, I can't believe that nanotech has had so much support from some of these same players that have shaped where we are today. So VP Gore on nanotechnology sees hope for environmental sustainability. Only days before he became a candidate for vice president, Senator Al Gore held hearings on, quote, new technologies for a sustainable world, which included testimony by Foresight President Eric Drexler. In an earlier issue, we printed Dr. Drexler's written testimony. And the following is the oral transcript, followed by a discussion with Senator Gore. Sorry, maybe we'll read a little bit of this. Dr. Drexler, this is him talking. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to address the committee on this topic that I believe one day will be a dominant concern within these halls. The focus of this hearing is particularly appropriate because a concern with long-term consequences of technology for human welfare and the environment has guided my research for many years. And guys, this is the 21st century cure to everything. Partly as a result of that concern, the technology that I'm about to discuss does address issues of industrial ecology, including decarbonization and dematerialization. What is that? As discussed by Dr. Osbell, and also addresses the wholesale transformation of the technology base called for by Dr. Banks. And I think we should look into Dr. Osbell and Dr. Banks, because I do not know who they are or what they were working on. I believe it does meet the criteria for an environmentally critical technologies. In the decades since I first discussed molecular nanotechnology in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, we've seen these ideas go from broad theoretical concepts to a set of detailed designs supported increasingly by computer simulation. And remember, this is back in 1992. It actually has happened in the lab, and now they've let some of these genies out of the bottle. Increasingly by computer simulation using state-of-the-art tools and drawing from chemistry, and to the beginnings of experimental demonstration of these crucial principles. As chairman of the Foresight Institute, I have chaired the Foresight Conference Series on Molecular Nanotechnology, and the most recent of these was co-sponsored by Stanford University as well as the University of Tokyo. There's strong interest in these topics in Japan, and Japan is still one of the mad science laboratories where they're doing a lot of research on crazy things such as nanotech. And I think it is shown by the recent commitment by the MITI of $185 million over the next 10 years to that effort that we described in the journal Nature. Momentum toward the development of this technology is building around the world, and I would like to briefly describe the results and the studies, and we are not going to go there. So where do we go from here? So nanotech, we also read George Bush had passed some nanotechnology commercialization act at the time, and had funded a lot of the nanotech research that has taken us by surprise because we did not realize how ubiquitous it already was in our environment. Now, one other interesting connection, going back to George Bush, vice presidents, and fracking, is the Halliburton connection with good old Dickie Cheney. And I was reading, too. Remember, Dickie Cheney had 5 different heart attacks, and people used to joke around about him being partially cyborg. Well, I was reading about his history last night, and one of the things that they had mentioned is in one of his later heart attacks, he needed a heart transplant, but they couldn't find one for like 20 months. And so they had put this implant into him. And what was very interesting is that the implant itself was what they call a MEMS, a microelectronic, some sort of MEMS device that they are using now to make some of these nano platforms. So Camille, I don't know, did you dig up anything new beyond Halliburton and them being involved in rebuilding Iraq? I also saw that because of some sort of energy policy in 2005, they had some big-ass loophole where they didn't have to adhere to, like, clean water standards and that.
Well, I know that Halliburton is one of the 10 companies that were the beginning of this advanced energy consortium with this Scott Tinker that we talked about a little bit ago. And they were founded just to put smart things into the well, just to put these smart little things into the well. And they're, Halliburton also, I had been looking at the fact that they've been 50 years in the Arctic doing their explorations up there.
Yeah, well, the Arctic, you know, and global warming and ice melting becomes very advantageous for the mining companies.
or ice breaking and melting, yes.
Yeah, pretty interesting. Well, so Scott Pinker, of course, was the one who thought it was such a great idea to shoot smart dust down the boreholes. There was a story out of 2010 out of the American Oil and Gas Reporter titled Advances in Nanotechnology Hold Huge Potential Promise for Upstream Applications in Regards to Oil Mining. Nanotechnology is making big leaps in potential applications in the oil and gas industry, and nanoscale technology has moved from science fiction into really hard engineering. They note that companies bringing to market commercial nanoscale products such as anti-corrosives and smart propants, as well as nanotubes that were once in the manufacturing labs, are now produced as tonnage, as by the ton, in Belgium, Germany, and Asia. And the evidence is the inclusion of nanoscale in a wide cross-section of disciplines, including physics, chemistry, and material science. Nanotechnology is also the focus of research projects at universities across the country, and oil and gas service companies are also involved, hiring nanotechnology specialists and supporting basic research. There are lots of new companies that are bringing commercial nanoscale products to market, and research shows that well-established chemical and physical properties do not hold any longer at the nanoscale, which is why we should be afraid. And instead, these nanoparticles may exhibit extraordinary magnetism or other changes in their micro and macro properties. And one of the things that's very frightening about some of this stuff is once you get to that nanoscale and elements react differently, they've been finding all kinds of ways to make superconductors and little miniature computers at the size of a nanometer. And you and I had run across a couple connections to this when we were looking. You had mentioned some of the connections you were seeing about Bell Labs, good old AT&T, to some of the nanotechnology. And we had read about some a few days ago. But when you were telling me about stuff you were reading in one of your books yesterday, you had mentioned Bell Labs being responsible for creating synthetic atoms, I think is what they had referred to them as. Is that what it was? Or artificial atoms?
Artificial atoms, yeah. And it looks like it was right around 1993.
Wow, so yeah. Right when they started messing with nanotechnology.
And how you had said all the universities around that they have working with this, just that Advanced Energy Consortium, they partner with over 25 universities and all sorts of industries just in the United States, but that goes global too. Sorry.
Well, that's the funding. I mean, DARPA and ARPA-E that you pointed out is the DARPA of the energy vertical. Now, one of the things that we discovered while we were trying to figure out what artificial atoms were is that when you search it on Wikipedia, it comes up as a quantum dot. And we just read about quantum dots the other day. Those are tiny, very, very small semiconductors that can be tuned to different wavelengths. And when we read about them the other day, it was in some sort of research paper, I was pointing out that because they could tune them to different colors, and that would be some of these quantum dot technologies that they are using with cadmium for quantum dot televisions. And I don't remember what they're calling that. QLED, I think, is what they're putting into the TVs. And they can tune them to different colors. And that would be very interesting if they could get these inside of you and use them as some sort of in vivo optogenetics. You know, they were talking about using them in the healthcare marketplace, but they would have to come up with something a little less toxic than cadmium. But there's all kinds of nano.
Maybe the gadolinium.
Gadolinium, there you go, or something of that sort. But it's very horrifying. So what were they doing with those artificial atoms? Do you remember?
Well, they said that they could make any kind, long ones, thin ones, big ones, round ones, and that then they could turn them into artificial molecules by building their own. And they refer to it all as their little toy box.
Toy box. Get the God toy box.
Yeah.
I mean, really, this goes back to like molecular manufacturing, but with synthetic elements.
Yes, so that they're not confined to the natural building blocks. This comes right after they created their artificial proteins too, so that they could work and engineer and fool to their heart's content.
Yeah, I think that's probably where I'll take the show next week, is we'll get into some of these artificial designer proteins, because it's pretty horrifying. I mean, they are rewriting everything that it means to be alive on this planet. They are taking it and they are perverting it into their own image of creation.
Oh, yeah. The guy that wrote this nano book, Ed Regis, people should look at his books, because the other thing he wrote was with George Church, Regenesis, and they want to make mirrors. They want everything to be mirrored so we're not as affected by germ or illnesses and sicknesses out there that to remake us. We'll reinvent nature and ourselves with synthetic biology. And he also writes about the biowarfare stuff. Very creepy. Very creepy guy.
Well, and that's, you know, with all this DIY CRISPR, good old Georgie Porgy Church, and then they let it all out of the bottle. I mean, people are able, and I thought I just saw a story the other day, though I don't have it up here. There was some sort of, I don't know if it was a cowpox or not a chicken pox, I don't know, it was some other animal pox, that they were able to CRISPR, and now they are afraid that there will be a resurgence of smallpox and other pox-like diseases because they were able to do mail order. Scientists, I think they're doing an experiment, and they did mail order pox, and they turned it into a pathogen that could infect millions because the smallpox vaccine, they stopped giving back in like the 80s. And so nobody has any immunity to this pox illness anymore.
Well, now they can make a new one and make more money.
Right. And I think they published how they did it, too.
Of course. That's sensible.
I was going to see if I could find... Oh, new smallpox-related virus. No, that was... Oh, look, it happened again. It happened in 2014 as well. Wait, there was mail. Let's do mail order. Mail order. And that was pretty frightening because these people who are recreating our world, and these are all, and actually something else that I wanted to touch on, but maybe we'll get there in a few minutes, is this mining and the billionaires and space mining and mining asteroids and that type of thing. And hold on 1 second. Because this really is, you know, they've been talking about getting off this rock for a very long time. And we always wondered why they would want to do that. Well, we know there's quintillions to be made. We saw in a story. And NASA is now jumping on board, as well as good old Elon Musk as part of his mission to Mars. And Jeff Bezos. And they have also jumped into bed with Space Command. Of course, Space Command has to guard the galaxy now against asteroids and different space weapons. I don't know. It's pretty insane how this is rolling out, and it all has to do with these mad science technologies. And you're like, what does nanotechnology have to do with space? Well, it's all about sensors. You had sent me a story out of Reason.com. And this was December 1995, which I thought was pretty interesting that it was that long ago. But they had already been talking about smart dust back in those days. Hewlett-Packard was involved in some of the early research. And they currently now have their, what do they call it? The nervous system of the Earth product. Nanotechnology promises endless abundance. And this is courtesy of molecule manipulating robots. Oh, is that nuts? And do we want it? They ask. Well, on June 26, 1992, which is that publication we just read about out of the Foresight Institute, at 9:30 in the morning, Dr. Eric Drexler arrives unaccompanied at room 53 of the Russell Senate Office Building. Drexler has a briefcase in one arm and a white cardboard box in the other. And in the box are 50 copies of his prepared statement titled Testimony of Dr. K. Eric Drexler on Molecular Nanotechnology before the Senate Subcommittee on Commerce, Science, Transportation, and Science, Technology, and Space. Drexler has been called to Washington, where he comes at his own expense from San Francisco, to tell country leaders about his fabulous intellectual creation, his trailblazing new ideas that, if successfully developed, would stand civilization on its head. Yay! I get excited about this. His scheme is to manufacture objects from molecules up, and I mean, this would be the ultimate replicator. You could make things by manipulating individual atoms and molecules, working with one at a time to position them precisely, lining them up one by one repeatedly until enough of them accumulate to form a large-scale usable entity. And this, of course, is his molecular manufacturing idea, such as cars or spaceships, with labor by a tiny fleet of invisible robots. Oh, these would be the self-replicating nanobots. These robots, when they are developed, would do all the work, and people could then sit back and enjoy themselves. Remember, there is no free lunch, drinking their mint juleps in peace and quiet. This was called nanotechnology, and the robots were called assemblers. Drexler was called crazy, or at least that was how some people regarded him the first time they heard about his radical new scheme. But good old Al Gore, who was the subcommittee chairman and the man who within the next few days would be announced as Bill Clinton's running mate, was a big fan of nanotechnology, and at any rate, he seemed to be au courant with the subject. What you're talking about when you use the phrase molecular nanotechnology is really a brand new approach to fabrication and to manufacturing, said Gore. The way we make things now, the way we take substance in bulk and then whittle it down to the size of the component we need, and then we put different components together and then we make something. But what you're describing with this phase of molecular nanotechnology is completely different, which rests on the principle that your first building block is the molecule itself. And what you're saying, yeah, Gore sounds pretty well-educated in it for 1995. And actually, it was back in 1992 when he said this. So what you're saying is that we have all the basic research breakthroughs that we need to build things one molecule at a time, and all we need is the applications of the research necessary to really doing it. What you're saying is that the advantages of taking a molecular approach are really quite startling. Well, yeah, so we had it at the very highest end of support through Bill Clinton's reign. And after Bill Clinton came George Bush, did it? Am I thinking that correctly? He did, right? After Clinton was Bush. And yeah. Then Bush reigned for two reigns, with Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, and we had 9/11 happen, and all of this surveillance technology rollout using millimeter waves at the airports and different biochemical sensors placed all over our big cities looking for bioterror attacks. Well, let's see.
It's all for a sustainable world.
It's all for a sustainable world, right? And this is how it's being sold to us now. So I had mentioned the other day, too, that they had smart dust sensors that were using piezoelectric energy harvesting in the environment using radio frequencies that, of course, are ambient everywhere. And as we roll out 5G, which is going to actually, that caught my attention. It reminded me of you. I saw something the other day about the new revision of Bell Labs, which is Nokia Bell Labs. This was out of a science publication in Europe titled 5G Technology to Monitor Air Quality. And this would be with the help of the University of Helsinki and Nokia Bell Labs. So it's going to be smart, precise, real-time data on environment and air quality monitoring. Again, in the name of sustainability. So we need to give 5G everywhere so we can get our wind direction and whether or not we have radiation or nanoparticles in the wind, and send you out real-time alerts on your cell phone. No, I don't know. It doesn't say that, but they could do it. You know, part of that smart city initiative that's being rolled out everywhere is about doing environmental monitoring as well as traffic monitoring. And that'd be a good reason to get smart dust into the ground, of course, so you could do pressure sensors and that type of stuff.
I have to wonder how long they've had the smart dust in the ground, because Tinker said that they worked for 3 years before they formed their consortium in 2008. And if they had already developed it, for him to be seeing it then in Colorado, it just makes me wonder how long. Is that why they can see this major increase in earthquakes in Texas that they've been tracking? They certainly have enough wells.
Yeah, they're all over.
Yeah.
Well, I just saw... getting back to smart dust, there was a story 4 days ago. Good old IBM is stepping to the plate. They unveiled the world's smallest computer that includes blockchain to boot at their new conference called Think 2018. They also announced their 5 in 5, which we used to, when I worked in technology way back when, back in tech support, we used to follow that IBM 5 and 5, where they would give you a look toward the future, the next 5 technologies that are coming big in 5 years. And one of the things that they were talking about were for water, AI-powered robot microscopes. And they look like little swimming crustaceans. It's completely insane. But... wait, where did it go here? I have so many tabs up. You guys don't realize, like, Camille and I don't get to talk a lot. We just send tons of emails, so this is a treat for both of us, but we both have so many different points to hit on. Here, if there is a downside to powerful computers, is that they're too damn big. So luckily, that is about to change if IBM has anything to say about it. March 19th, 2018. Was the first day of IBM's Think 2018, which is a flagship conference where the company unveils what it claims to be the world's smallest computer. And they are not kidding. It is literally smaller than a grain of sand. Ding. But don't let the size fool you. The sucker has a computing power of an x86 chip from 1990. So that's not great compared to what we have today, but cut it some slack. You need a microscope to see it. The computer costs less than 10 cents to manufacture, and it'll also pack several 100,000 transistors, according to the company. It will allow us to, quote, monitor, analyze, communicate, and even act on data. Don't worry, Bitcoin brothers. It works with blockchain, and specifically, this computer will be a data source for blockchain applications. It is intended to track shipments of goods and detect theft, fraud, and non-compliance. It can also do basic AI tasks, such as sort the data that it is given. According to IBM, this is only the beginning. Within the next 5 years, what they are calling cryptographic anchors, such as tiny ink dots, and I was wondering if those were some of those quantum dots, or tiny computers that are smaller than a grain of sand, will be embedded in everyday objects and devices. And if they are correct, we will see way more of these tiny systems in objects and devices in years to come. But it is not clear when it'll be released. IBM researchers are currently testing their first prototype. But one thing is for sure, the future is here, and you might need a microscope to see it. I mean, how crazy is that? The size of a grain of sand, and it shows in the diagram here, it's got a photovoltaic cell on it, so it's doing some sort of solar power, and some sort of communications via LED, so it's going to be doing like light communications, so maybe those are those quantum dots, and then several 100,000 transistors.
It's funny that that's IBM, because according to this nano book in 86 when AT&T first was able to manipulate atom by atom. Right after that, they were blown out of the water by IBM being able to put it down and remove it. So they've been right there since the very, very beginning of manipulating atom.
Big Blue actually has been there from the very beginning. Even, I mean, I believe that they created one of the very first desktop computers. It was IBM's PS2 or something like that. Well, one of the other players that's been involved in this, of course, is the federal government. And IBM has been working with, like, Los Alamos Laboratory and different agencies like that, as well as Air Force and Department of Defense. I actually just saw a DARPA request for proposal, which was from 2016, and I really didn't find a lot of updates except that Columbia University won one of the awards. But this was titled Control Systems and Biology. Now, you know that they're working on trying to get these sensors through our healthcare system into our bodies to be able to track our health like a dashboard on a car, so they could tell us when we're operating within parameters and when we're showing signs of getting ill, or maybe detecting cancerous growths on the fly. Well, this was biological control systems from DARPA. Just makes you wonder, like, what the hell would they would do with something like this if it were not to control some sort of biological entity. This program seeks to build the foundations for multi-scale control of biological systems. Specifically, DARPA is seeking to develop new capabilities for the control of biological systems across scales from nanometer size to centimeters, seconds to weeks, and biomolecules to populations of organisms, like large ones, using embedded controllers made of biological parts to program system-level behavior. Ding, ding, ding. Now, you know, they've talked about behavior monitoring before, and there was something about them looking at true intentions, and they also came up with some new neurological interface that makes you wonder about the connections here. They wanted to use embedded controllers made of biological parts to program system-level behavior, and this program will apply and advance existing control theory to design and implement generalized biological control strategies analogous to conventional control engineering, for example, such as mechanical and electrical systems today. The resulting advances in fundamental understanding and capabilities will create new opportunities for engineering biology. The program will demonstrate tools to rationally design and implement multi-scale, closed-loop control of biological systems through the development of biological controllers, testbeds to evaluate control of system-level behavior, and theory and models to predict and design effective control strategies. And of course, we're going to use artificial intelligence to do the modeling and the prediction to design their effective control strategies. It's just like a war game. The resulting capabilities will be inherently generalized to a variety of biological systems. They're not quite mentioning what. And successful teams will integrate and apply these capabilities to demonstrate a practical proof of principle biological solution to a proposer-defined application relevant to the U.S. Department of Defense. And this is falling under DARPA's Biological Technology Office. What do you think of them apples? I mean, they're talking about singularly controlling at a nanoscale all the way up to a biological population control and modeling and surveillance. Pretty frightening.
It's amazing that the people in the industries that are still doing work for DARPA, I think they must already be using these little controls in order to get people. How can this be okay? How can this be something that people are on board with? I don't know.
Well,
and then
you have to.
The energy is modeled right after DARPA.
Right. I mean, as far as funding and coming up with moonshot projects, as they call them, and giving them to our best and our brightest at the universities with dangling carrots of money to then make them work for their industry to develop things that are off the rails crazy. You know, you got to check your ethics at the door, I think, when you develop things like that. Well, because when you look at the end result, go ahead.
People that are doing what they're told, these universities, who would think that you'd be led into building your own destruction? But they're using these universities for doing all the development on this stuff, and that has to be cheap. Don't people pay to go to school in the first place, and then they're building all of these things, and then they get monetized by the companies and the government? But you were saying, sorry.
Right. I mean, they sell them or they spin them out as IPOs and then turn them into some sort of, medical company. I do know that DARPA really would like to monitor soldiers real time as far as like a Fitbit, which they found out just recently. Fitbits on soldiers give away locations.
Yeah.
One of the other things that they've been working on, of course, are the brain-computer interfaces. And there was another one that came out just last week titled, and this is out of the DARPA.gov, non-surgical neural interfaces could significantly expand the use of neurotechnology. New program seeks high-resolution neural images for use by able-bodied service members. Oh, put on your skull cap if you're going into the field. State-of-the-art brain system communications has employed invasive techniques, which typically required some sort of implant electrode. But to receive high-quality connections to specific neurons or neuron groups, these techniques have helped patients with, of course, brain injuries and other illnesses. However, they are not appropriate for able-bodied people. DARPA now seeks to achieve high-level brain system communication without surgery in its new program called the Next Generation Non-Surgical Neurotechnology, or N to the third power for short. What was that?
Eat your Cheetos.
Eat your Cheetos, right. Get your nanotechnology. And DARPA created N3 to pursue a path to safe, portable neural interface systems capable of reading them and writing them to multiple points in the brain at once. Says Dr. Al Imundai, program manager in DARPA's Biological Technologies office. So it's the same office that was looking at doing control systems in biology. High-resolution non-surgical neurotechnology has been elusive, but thanks to recent advances in biomedical engineering, neuroscience, synthetic biology, and nanotechnology, we now believe that the goal is attainable. Non-invasive neurotechnologies, such as an electrocephalogram, which you can get your EEG for $30, and that's going to be available in every school, to every school child, and transcranial direct current stimulation already exists, but offer nowhere near the precision, signal resolution, and portability required for advanced applications working in real-world settings. Potential N3 researchers will face numerous scientific and engineering challenges, but to bypass those limitations, the biggest obstacle will be overcoming the complex physics of scattering and weakening of signals as they pass through the skull, the skin, and brain tissue. We are asking for multidisciplinary teams of researchers to construct approaches that enable precise interactions with very small areas of the brain without sacrificing signal resolution of introducing acceptable latency into the N3 system. Only technologies to be considered an N3 must have a viable path forward eventually for use in healthy humans. And what I think is pretty telling is one of these companies that my co-writer and I covered in one of our new technologies coming in the not too distant future stories was brain controlled interfaces. And there was a company named Emotive that had a commercialized EEG already that you could do all kinds of things with. Like, I think emotive, you might have been able to dial up and dial down your emotions or your mental state just by changing the frequency. But listen to this one. This, I think, was a pretty new story. I don't know if it says, but it just came into my feed yesterday, I believe. Titled Emotive Headset.
You could dial it up or they could.
Right, to mass mind control. This is March 21st, so 2 days ago, 2018. Emotive's headset reads your brain and lets you control drones with your mind. So we've also democratized drone swarms. I saw the Department of Defense and one of the defense companies had just come out with some sort of laser beam that can shoot down entire swarms of drones. Emotive has presented its Insight headset at Dubai last week, because they had some big smart technology conference in Dubai, which is a technology allowing users to control electronic devices like drones with their mind. The last time we reported on mind-controlled drone technology was at Arizona State University's, how many times have we run across them, Human-Oriented Robotics and Control Lab, that was leading the charge with a project funded by DARPA. Yes, DARPA and their mind-controlled drones. At the Global Education and Skills Forum in Dubai last week, Australian-based Emotive presented the latest consumer-targeted advancement in this field. Like the aforementioned tech being researched by Arizona State, Emotive's Insight headset serves as an EEG, which recognizes the brain's electrical impulses and turns those outputs into inputs for drones or other devices. Emotive's tech isn't exclusively focused on drones, but the electronic devices in general have a potential for use cases for those afflicted, of course, with physical disabilities. But taken to its fullest potential, a technology like this could allow for non-able-bodied persons to set their alarms, to turn on their TVs, start their dishwashers, or send emails, yes, or for the lazy person, all with their thoughts. And with the proper funding, research, and motivation, this could lead to endless life-altering results. But however, Emotive's headset is just in its early stages and only concluded its first public unveiling for the aforementioned forum last week. Naturally, asking consumers to wear a stupid-looking device on their head is rarely, if ever, a way into their hearts. But no, they got to sell it. So from Google Glasses to the primitive 3D lenses sold at movie theaters, consumers aren't that keen on appearing abnormal. But on the other hand, if I told you these very same consumers could wear this new Emotive headset and use it to type, surf the internet, turn on their lights, check their text messages, all without lifting a finger, lazy consumers, I'm pretty certain their credit cards would already be in hand. Presuming, of course, that the price is right, we've talked about that, $99 or below. And for those with enough disposable income and curiosity, it seems pretty reasonable. So what are we going to do? Mind-controlled drone fleets are coming, say researchers from Arizona State University's Human-Oriented Robotics and Control Lab. Dun, dun, dun. So now we have to worry about that. And here was the next story out of NewAtlas.com. Microwave laser weapons to take out multiple drone swarms being made by Raytheon, who is another military contractor. And, you know, Raytheon stock, I actually put a search on them in my Google daily digest alerts, and Raytheon stock on a daily basis has been going up, I don't know, after the downfall yesterday, but probably for the last few good months, every day their stock has gone up. So that means there's a lot of investment in military technologies, and especially using some of the newfangled stuff, such as nanotech and lasers. So I don't know, where do we end this up? We were going to get into space mining, but I don't really see a way to get there from here. So maybe what we'll do is, there were a few stories that have been sitting in my queue all week that I want to make sure we touch on. So maybe we can talk about these. We've talked about surveillance and, of course, nanotechnology, smart dust, smart cities, and these tiny little sensors, the grain of size of a grain of sand, being all throughout our environments, is going to allow a central authority to be monitoring, bagging, and tagging everything that happens in our environment. And of course, one of the places that is ahead of all others in mad science gone mad, as well as surveillance with a complete lack of privacy concerns, is China. Well, anyone who has watched Black Mirror, and if you haven't, I highly recommend it. It is a very good series that is a glimpse into our not-too-distant future. There was a Black Mirror episode a while ago, and I don't remember the name of it, but one of the things that had happened is they were looking at the future of social media and everybody having an account and interacting online and things that you post or getting likes or dislikes from others. And they had taken it just a step further than where we have it now, but you could see that it could easily go there. All of your interactions with people in your circle of influence, whether it be in public or online, gave you what they call a social credit score. And if you piss somebody off and they give you a thumbs down or you get a band of trolls that come after you, it could really affect the way you are allowed to participate with the society around you. Well, a Black Mirror episode is now coming to life in China. You would have guessed it. People will be prevented from traveling on trains and planes based upon their future social credit scores. In another indication that Black Mirror isn't just a science fiction anthology series, but instead a glimpse into our actual future, China is extending its social credit system to block accused wrongdoers from traveling on trains or planes. A social credit program has been around since 2014, and it has steadily been expanding. According to Wired Magazine, in 2014, the State Council, which is China's governing cabinet, publicly called for the establishment of a nationwide tracking system to rate the reputations of every individual, business, and even government officials. And what I'm going to add to that is the blockchain would be a perfect way to do that, since if they have some centralized database that is quote-unquote unmutable, anything that you have ever done will be recorded and collated, bagged and tagged, and tied back to some sort of digital ID system that they are creating for everybody on the planet. We read about that digital ID 2020 tied to the blockchain. Doing volunteer work, donating blood, and recycling can all boost one's social credit score while incurring debt or criticizing the government, oh, like when YouTube blocks your videos, can render you blacklisted for bullying, which would allow you to be unable to buy property, take out loans, or engage in some sort of mass travel. It is all eerily similar to Black Mirror's third episode called Nosedive. Yeah, that's what it was called, which imagined a world controlled by such a system. And even featured a scene in which the star is ejected from the airport for having a too low social score to secure a seat on a flight. Thank God we have Black Mirror to cushion our continued march toward global dystopia, because here it comes, people. And if it can't get more dystopic, there was also another story that came out on March 15th, 2018. A giant U.S. retailer, and that would be Walmart, just filed a patent for autonomous robo-bees. And it even goes a bit further, because there was a Black Mirror episode about robo-bees as well. Just like an episode of Black Mirror, it starts out, Walmart has filed a patent for autonomous robo-bees, technically called pollinator drones, that could potentially pollinate crops just like real bees. And we read a lot about nanotechnology as well being used in agriculture and doing remote sensing on crops, water, environment, air quality, pollution levels, etc. Guys, this is all coming. This smart robotic AI intelligent micro future is pretty damn horrifying to me, and especially considering the fact that they want to get it into every part of our environment and make you a part of the monitoring system. These drones would carry pollen from one another, from one plant to another, using sensors and cameras to detect the locations of the crops. And the RoboB patent appears along with five other patents for farming drones, including ones that would identify pests and another that would monitor your crop health. And maybe these would even be mind controlled. Walmart did not immediately respond to Business Insider's request for comment. But while Walmart's exact goals for these patents is unclear, they may signal that the company hopes to venture into agricultural and gain more control over its food supply chain. Yeah, all they had to do then was put their information onto a blockchain so they could follow where every leaf from every spinach plant goes, and we have a winner. So, Camille, what do you think about smart technology and bringing on the smart city? I know you've done a lot of research into things that are going on around you at home. What are your thoughts on some of this stuff?
There are so many applications for the smart city thing, but I have to say, you're talking about Walmart and you're talking about the bees. Here locally, what I'm hearing is that they've stopped taking milk from local farmers. They're opening, Walmart is opening its own milk production factory that everybody's up in arms about here. So they're going to have their robo bees pollinating their plants, and they're going to have their own milk, which I don't know where their cows are, but. But the
hopefully
smart,
it's
the smart
not
city
the genetically
thing.
Modified cows in China.
or the Perfect Day Foods brewed milk that doesn't even require cows. That would be.
That's under the artificial food heading. Artificial food is coming.
Milk.
What was that?
They just have to remove the, they say it's real milk. They just remove that step the cow does.
Right, and the cow, of course, produces methane, so it's a sustainable milk product. Save the world, Al Gore. I don't know. It just is so disturbing. And one of the things that's so great is Camille likes to go down rabbit holes like I do. So we exchange a lot of links and have some good conversations as sidebars. So it was quite a pleasure to have you on today. Now, you have your own blog on Steemit.
Yes.
Link is at Camille1234. So let's see.